This is how I think we get to a billion users in crypto. We have to have that Google moment where you can just show up, type in the magic box what you want to do, it understands your intent, sets everything up, and you push a button to it. Right? I don't know if you guys remember the internet before Google.
Oh, yeah.
But it was janky, right? a lot of directories, a lot of IP addresses. It's like crypto today. Right, it was accessible by a few hundred million highly technical people,
right.
But to get to a billion, you needed to get past that. So that's what I think AI gives crypto.
Welcome to the ATX DAO podcast, the hub for exploring the forefront of blockchain technology and Austin's Web3 community. Your hosts, Nick, Mason, Luke, and Ash, connect you with innovators within ATX DAO and beyond as we venture into the world of decentralized technology. So crack open a beer and join us for a front row seat to learn about the innovations and trends shaping our digital future. This is the ATX DAO podcast.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to another episode of the ATX DAO podcast. Today, we have the privilege and honor of having David Johnston on the show. Welcome, David.
Cool. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Thanks. We're going to dig in, and there's a bunch of stuff we want to talk about. Exciting project that you're working on, and lots of details that make this project really pretty interesting. Just to kick things off, just give us your background a little bit. How you know, I was reading up on your bio, and you have a fascinating background, for one. You've built a ton of companies. You've been in the tech space for a long time. So we'd love to hear even a little bit about your journey into entrepreneurship and how that led you down this path to tech.
Sure. So got into Web3, I guess, in 2012, back when it was just Bitcoin. Lucky, I was a free market economics nerd. And so a friend told me about Bitcoin. I was like, wait a minute. So non-governmental money that'll never be inflated and is controlled by math. Yeah. How do I change my green pieces of paper into that? Right. So it wasn't easy at the time. So it took like 4 months for me to convert all my cash into Bitcoin. And it was kind of funny when I finished the process, I told my wife, hey, I traded all of our dollars for Bitcoin. She's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you forgot to convert our retirement savings into Bitcoin. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. And she's like, yeah, why would we hold dollars? They're inflationary and only lose value. Obviously, you should trade for the Bitcoin. This is economics 101. I was like, God, I love you. Yes. To be fair, we were nerding out on free market economics on our first date. So there was good indications, but yeah, that's definitely the bar you want to shoot for in a spouse. So yeah, you know, I built a bunch of tech companies when I was as younger, you know, sort of caught the edge of the dot-com wave in the 90s and 2000s. And, you know, pretty much. I also experimented a lot with virtual currency back in 2006, 2007. Do you guys remember Second Life?
Oh yeah. Yeah, of course. Linden's.
The Linden dollar. Yeah. That was my introduction to virtual currency. But do you guys remember when Second Life died? I can tell you exactly why it died. In January of 2007, the regulators walked into the offices of Linden Labs, and they're like, do you have any idea what people are doing in the world? There were casinos, there were stock markets, there were, you know, currency trading operations. They're like, you have to shut all of this down, right? And so they basically, in January of 2007, killed all the interesting use cases in the Linden Labs, you know, Second Life world. Right. And it went from this hockey stick of growth to just becoming another game,
Yeah. Basically.
And so when I saw Bitcoin in 2012, I was like, oh, this is an unstoppable open source Linden dollar. Yeah. There is no company and there is no office and it's just a protocol. And I realized that the genius was Satoshi had separated protocol layer from the application layer. If you wanted to build Coinbase, you could still build Coinbase, but you were doing it at the application layer.
Right.
And you were compliant with specific laws in a specific jurisdiction, but the protocol was just math.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It didn't know the state it existed. It just kept working. It's like, wow, I know exactly what people are going to do with this. Yeah. Right. They're going to do gambling. They're going to do assets. They're going to do value transfer. They're going to do remittances. All these cool use cases that, you know, were so amazing with Second Life will have a rebirth. Right. And so people are like, oh, that was so risky that you went in all in Bitcoin. It's like, no. I'd already been very familiar with these use cases and it aligned with my economics. So I was like, let's go.
It is really crazy how that just disappeared. I knew people who were deep in Second Life. I mean, they had businesses, they were selling things, like they were making real money in this virtual world. And everybody thought they were off their rocker and like, what are you doing? You're on a computer for 13 hours a day. Right. And then that just kind of evaporated. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, it never really went away. It's still there. It has maybe the same 5 million users it did in 2007. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, you know, burrowed into sort of like niches around, you know, small communities that want to do stuff in a virtual world. But once you killed all the financial rails, like all the most compelling stuff went away, right? The guy that wanted to send remittances to his family in the third world, like that went away, you know, all the asset creation, that kind of stuff went away. So
they killed innovation.
Yeah. And it's been amazing, you know, how many times in my life I've seen them sort of, you know, something cool exists and you're like, why did that go away? Usually the state. Like almost always it's regulatory pressure or something else like that. Oh, so
we're going to talk more about that.
Yeah.
Now you can do those, all that stuff on Roblox.
It's true.
Yeah, that's true.
With the eyes of everybody on you.
Yeah. Roblox, also Minecraft, you know, Minecraft, all those things have sort of taken up that niche. Like this is 150 million users, right? Of Minecraft. It's a huge ecosystem.
One of them.
Yeah. It's just unfortunately inside those four walls.
Right. So you're a Bitcoin OG. You found it early. You saw the vision. You knew where this was headed. Bring us up to speed on how you got to, you know, today and the last couple of cycles. What were you doing? What were you getting into? What have you been interested in?
So I would describe myself as a freedom maximalist, right? I try not to get sucked into like the tribal politics of one particular chain. And so I wrote the paper on decentralized applications in October of 13. And I basically put forth, hey guys, let's take all those great things about Bitcoin, open source, peer-to-peer, built on a blockchain and has a token, and use that as a general framework for building other protocols, right? Because the controversial part at the time was having a token. Right. There's a lot of Bitcoin maxi told me there could only be one token and anything else was a scam. Yeah. I literally got death threats in those days. Like people were like, hey guys, I thought this was free markets competition. And so, you know, once I sort of put that framework out there and it's like, hey, let's call these dApps. If it doesn't fit those four criteria, it's not really a dApp, because the key insight is without a token, there's no way for the software to pay for its own hardware. You can't have a really neutral, credible platform without the independence of the protocol paying people to do real world things that make it operate.
Yeah.
Whether that's hash power or storage or compute or anything else, like it all comes from that, right? You had to put the payment mechanism in the hands of the software and not somebody's checkbook.
Yeah.
As long as it's somebody's checkbook, like they owned that protocol, right? Which is why none of the private chains have taken off. Because as soon as somebody turns off the server, it just goes away. There's no incentive for persistence.
Right.
And so once people sort of grokked that idea, like, cool, let's use this as a framework. And I worked on Ethereum. I worked on a bunch of other early protocols, ended up helping start one of the first angel groups, Bit Angels in 2013 to fund a lot of that, one of the first VCs to do tokens. Just kept following that path. Ironically, I was telling you guys earlier, the last thing I did before crypto was AI. Back when we called it natural language processing and machine learning, right? There were no transformers. There was no ChatGPT.
What year was that?
That was 2012, 2013.
Okay. That was like in the days of DragonSpeak.
Yeah.
And they were using natural language processing.
Yeah. Exactly. But the infrastructure really wasn't there yet. And so I was like, I think this is going to be a thing, but it's a decade too early. And so I ended up just focusing totally on crypto for the last 10, 12 years. But to answer your question, I kind of looked up after a recent project and I was like, AI stuff's come a long way. Like it is now doing 2022 things we were dreaming of in 2012, right? That it would be able to understand intent, take actions, and these agents would emerge. And so in 23, I ended up writing a paper called the Smart Agents Protocol, because a lot of people were asking, okay, how do we align AI with people so that we get good outcomes, right? And I was like, well, there's things called a private key and a public key. 400 million people have a Web3 wallet. Cryptography is a pretty good way to prove that you expressed an intent, signed a transaction, that the agent is acting on your behalf. and nobody else's. And so that was my proposal in the Smart Agent Protocol paper. Also wrote a paper on smart contract rank. Mm-hmm. It's like, if we want to teach AI Web3, we have to basically give it the knowledge of the smart contracts and create a way to connect that into the large language models.
Yeah, I was playing with the chat proof of concept today.
Yeah.
Asking it some questions. And it's a great model. It makes total sense. What I love about it is that it's really easy to understand.
Right.
You know, like human readable. So you can understand the weighting and it makes sense in terms of the different factors. So.
Right. And so that was basically my 2023 was writing and thinking about that problem. You know, wrote the algorithm, the paper, a community started coming together around this idea of smart agents, right? And again, creating a term to describe your personal AI connected to your data controlled by your wallet.
Yeah.
Right. That's a smart agent.
Yeah.
That's bringing AI agents and smart contracts together in a way that's really interesting. And now it can take an action on your behalf, not just give you information, a bullet list of things you got to do. It can build a transaction for you. It can set everything up and you can approve. And the payoff is, this is how I think we get to a billion users in crypto. We have to have that Google moment where you can just show up, type in the magic box what you want to do, it understands your intent, sets everything up, and you push a button to it. Right? I don't know if you guys remember the internet before Google.
Oh, yeah.
But it was janky, right? a lot of directories, a lot of IP addresses. It's like crypto today, right? It was accessible by a few hundred million highly technical people.
Right.
But to get to a billion, you needed to get past that. So that's what I think AI gives crypto, is this interface that's just chat. You don't need any technical knowledge. You don't have to know what the name of the smart contract is. Most people have never heard of Lido, right? But if they say, oh, I want to stake my ETH, I heard that's a thing, right? The LLM can detect that intent and say, okay, cool. Probably want to use Lido, $20 billion, you know, already well used. It's built on Ethereum. Push this button on MetaMask, right? That flow is so much simpler, right? That's how we get to a billion people. And that's what got me excited about this.
Yeah, I mean, because if you extrapolate the concept and you take that to mainstream audiences and you start thinking about, like, how do I start basically deploying my financial agents to take care of my life or to, you know, run my investment strategies? Like, very easy to do that on a button. And like you're saying, like, as soon as people have that moment of, oh, that's really pretty cool, I don't care what the technology is. You can call it whatever you want. And I'm not scared of it anymore because that's really cool. And I want that to happen all the time.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it also feels like a natural progression, right? Before we all had personal computers, there were terminals connected to mainframes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But as soon as the tech got there, everybody wanted to own their own data.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted a personal computer. I mean, telephones started the same way.
Yep.
Right? You were calling into a central switchboard, right? Yeah. But eventually, like, I want my photos, I want all my stuff on my own device. And so I think the natural evolution, you can have a personal AI.
I would love a smart agent. That sounds dope. Yeah.
It's there right now. Download it, start playing with it. Yeah. There you go.
It seems like just naturally. It's like this perfect execution. That's really what we're trying to do. And it makes a lot of sense to try and have these kinds of functionalities like natively built in.
Right.
So that like a user like comes in, like you said, and they're like, I don't know if this is Web3 or Web2. I really don't know if this is AI or not AI.
Right.
I'm just asking this thing to do this thing for me. You know, and then she can do everything for me and order me a pizza at the same time and tell me there's a pizza DAO party as well.
Yeah.
That's fucking awesome.
And isn't that how we interact with all of the technology in our life eventually? Like, we don't care what's under the hood. It just, it makes food. It gets me to the store. Like, we don't care.
Ultimately, it feels like there's this weird kind of thing, right? And I've noticed it over the holidays, right? I was telling these guys, like, in the previous podcast, like, we were in St. Louis, right? Forest Park. I love Forest Park. I'm not getting paid by Forest fucking Park, but I should get paid by Forest Park.
I'm pretty sure you are.
Yeah.
You're yield farming their token.
By the end of 2024, I'm basically on the board of directors there. Like, but, like, no, I mean, like, when I was there, it was really funny. Like, it was that weird moment that also occurred. And I never really thought about it until my mom just pulled it up on her phone because she was visiting. She had a ChatGPT on her phone, and she used that more than Google to like try and then use that. That's kind of a crazy, weird moment, right?
Yeah.
It's like a switch moment. And like, that's like retail, just picking up to the idea that if I want to query, like, this is just a better query.
Yep.
Now, if it's like, if I can query and execute, and that's like on a mobile interface, that's fucking amazing.
Sure.
Well, you know, I was having a conversation with somebody recently, and I was like, I was a little frustrated because I was interacting with somebody and they weren't able to find something through Google or DuckDuckGo or something. And I gave it a couple of searches and I was like, well, there you go. And I realized that like searching, good querying, has kind of become a lost art.
Yep.
And because we have the convenience now of being able to ask better, like more natural questions, and the machine knows what we want and it goes out and our smart agent someday will go out and get that for us. So it is really definitely, it's a evolutionary change in the way we interact.
Yeah. And just to build on that comment, this is what Google's terrified of. They're losing market share, right, to AI. Like, why should I go do a web search when the answers are there?
Yes.
Right. In a nice summarized. So it's classic innovator's dilemma.
Yeah.
Right. The faster they adapt this, the more, you know, they'll lose revenue. But if they don't do it, they'll lose to their competitor.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I think that's where this regulatory capture and the executive order and all these new regulations that will effectively get rid of startups in the AI world that can't meet this bar. I think that's where it came from.
Can you walk us through that? Because I think the listeners, like, that's not everybody knows about what's happening. And
really sure. Important. So end of October last year, Biden administration signed into law the executive order on AI. Right. And an executive order says, hey, there's already a law. National Defense Authorization Act that says, oh, we have to protect the American public from dangers and weapons and this stuff. And we're just going to say AI is a weapon. And so to mitigate this danger, you know, Homeland Security needs to start a process where people register new models. We need to limit access of foreigners to US compute in case they want to train an AI model, right? If you listen to the Secretary of Commerce, she's like, look, we can't let, China get access to US AI tech. Therefore, we must ban open source AI for some reason. That's her conclusion, right? So the banning of the weights, that would be through this dual use determination. That means it can be used for both civilian commercial applications, but also military, right? They're trying to pretend like linear algebra is a weapon that needs to be regulated. And so it'll become illegal in the US to release potentially in July these models. Right, over a certain limit.
I just want to say what they should probably focus on is probably ASML, which had a record 2023 year of sales and is projecting for 2024 to be fucking insane. And those right. of you who don't know what ASML is, they're the guys who basically make the machines that make the chips that make everything else.
Yep.
So maybe you should be focusing on that shit and like all that stuff that happens to be slipping over to our so-called competitors. Rather than the fact of like distributed AI and models and data sets.
But wait a minute, how does that benefit Google?
That's a very good question.
Yeah. They don't care.
We'll get back to that question right after our sponsorship from Google.
Yeah. No. So, you know, when these new regulations came out, which will basically implement KYC for data centers, right? So if you enjoyed KYC for your money, get ready for KYC for your data center and compute. Right, to prove you aren't a foreign person that can access. They've set these parameters so low. 10 billion parameters will be, you know, if models are above that, it needs to be licensed. That's 20 gigs. You could put on your personal laptop a model, which, you know, they're claiming is dangerous, is ridiculous.
Put that on your phone.
You could put that on your phone, right? Yeah. You know, and they've set a compute limit and all these things. So this action in October just really, you know, woke up the AI community, who have been living in this beautiful bubble where they had infinite funding and it was the hot new thing, to, oh, I'm not going to get my next round because I'm not going to get registered with home security. I'm not going to have a safety committee. I can't afford these 50 other barriers that are being implemented. I need to pivot towards decentralization, right? And you started to see Balaji, you started to see Eric Voorhees, you started to see Mark Andreessen, everybody sort of in the know. It's like, if you're in AI, you need to be centralized by next year. You got a timeline. Like, do it by July. So we ended up throwing a party, Keep AI Open in San Francisco. We announced it in the morning. We had 700 people show up. that evening, right? And Eric Voorhees DJed and Grimes was there and a lot of the AI researchers were there. Wow. And I was like, this is a moment. Like, yeah. We're not going to let them take over all future thought, intelligence, you know, ability to access information. Like, that's not a battle we can lose, right? So we got to do this. We got to do this now. And that's what inspired doing the decentralized AI summit here in Austin in December.
Yeah, I mean, that's a super willing. I do not want to live in that.
No, thanks. Yeah. No, thanks.
It's really funny how regulation seems to like create these like binary kind of distribution. It's not even a distribution, like binary outcomes, right? Yep. Like you either have like a complete free market kind of opportunity, or you have like a completely privatized and most likely militarized kind of approach, right?
Right.
Because if it seems like this regulation by extension would just be like, oh, okay, you want to work in AI? Great. You have to do all these things. And then guess where this only really works? It works in enterprise level stuff, which is huge, or it works for the government and it works for the military.
Yep.
So it's like anything and all in between that is a consumer level kind of like deployment is fucked, right? Like it's just never going to work.
Sure.
So, I mean, this is definitely a, you know, an interesting thing to like, you know, like look at like crypto policy and then just be like, yo, crypto policy has this huge thing overlap in a Venn diagram, like AI policy as well, right?
So, yep. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way they've written the executive order, it's so broad. You could even interpret it as affecting search engines. It literally defines it as anything where you could find information and, you know, get an answer or like that's everything.
It feels like the AI equivalent of you will own nothing and be happy.
Yeah.
You know, yes. You will just take this algo that we created for you and that's going to be your experience.
Right.
Yeah. And the other funny thing is that like really you're thinking about it and you can look at it as like three different, like for a dummy like me, I just look at it as like three different components, right? I look at it as like the hardware to do the compute,
yep.
Right? One thing is just and then the model. And the third thing to just be the data set to like effectively make the model work, right?
Yep.
And then the fourth element, which is not really part of this trilemma, is like really just the user interacting with these three components.
Right? Yep.
And like now they're effectively saying, I want this, this, and this all to be underneath my purview, which is like, bro, like what the fuck?
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, exactly. We've already tried this kind of game like before, right? You know, the eras that you're talking about, it seemed like regulation never really made very much sense over there too.
Yep. Well, I mean, that's why I kind of refer to this as the Crypto Wars 2.0. Like, if you guys remember 91, they proposed a bill to ban encryption for emails.
Yep.
And that's what inspired Phil Zimmerman to release PGP, right? Pretty good privacy. Ended up being one of the best, you know, encryption standards. And, you know, famously, he printed it on a T-shirt, walked across the border and asked to be arrested because it was illegal to disclose this magical math to a foreign person, right? So they arrested him, and of course he won in court. For some reason, judges were unwilling to ban math or T-shirts or books or language or something like something about the First Amendment. Yeah, something about free speech. You know, basically won on free speech grounds, right? But it wasn't until 1999 that they formally rescinded restrictions on encryption when finally Google and Microsoft came around to lobby them. That well, we kind of want to sell commercial software internationally. We kind of need strong encryption for that. You guys can get rid of these rules. That's great. So, but it basically was a 9 years of the cryptography wars. Ironically, do you remember who proposed that restriction in 19? It was Joe Biden. Wow. I kid you not. He is that damn old. 33 years later, still trying to ban math, right? And it's not going to work any more today than it worked back then, but we got to pull a Phil Zimmerman. Got to open source all this stuff. We got to build this decentralized AI tech stack.
Yeah.
We got to make this law effectively impossible to enforce because it's nonsensical. It'll probably never hold up in the courts, but do you want to wait 5 years, you know, for the courts to get around to that or 10 years for the government
and suppress innovation? That
yeah,
time. And can anyone exactly. afford to have that court battle?
Exactly. Well, and if you look at Web3 as an example, you had the Bit License pass in 2014, set up a $30 million regulatory barrier. And you need basically a bank charter, right? And it forced most of the early crypto stuff out of the US.
Yeah.
Right. And it went to Singapore, it went to Switzerland, it went everywhere else, right? And now finally, there's a few firms that have enough resources. They're fighting in court and winning against the SEC and getting justice. But yeah, you need a big budget and a long period of time. So clearly, we have to build this organic community from the ground up. Eventually, we'll have the resources to fight this stuff. In the courts. But in the meantime, Bitcoin didn't care, you know, what the laws were. It doesn't know the laws exist. It's just a neutral protocol. So we have to get down to that protocol layer again.
So I think that's a great segue. Let's talk about the community behind this. Let's talk about more.
Sure.
Let's talk about how, what you're building, what you're working on, what the community is building, tackle some of this problem.
Sure. So, you know, the timing was pretty crazy because these anonymous developers calling themselves Morpheus, Trinity, and Neo dropped the Morpheus paper, I think it was September 2nd of last year, which I noticed later
Where
is
they drop it?
They sent it to people in the smart agents community, right? There's already people talking about this idea.
Right.
And they're like, look, guys, this is great, but you need a network. There needs to be a way for you can call compute, right, from other people's. Because not everybody has a GPU. Right. So if this is only a local install, it's not that interesting. We need a whole network to empower smart agents. They need compute, they need code, they need front ends, they need capital, right? That's what all of these projects need. And I happen to run into Eric Voorhees and we're hanging out at Permissionless, September 9th, right? 1 week later. And we could already see some of the regulatory stuff coming. And he was like, yeah, we got to build decentralized AI. This is the next thing they're going to crack down on. We didn't expect it would be literally the next month in October when they dropped the executive order. Right? We thought maybe we had till 2024 or 2025, but like, no. And so the community just came together organically. There's no company, there's no foundation. Nobody even knows who the authors of the paper are. But within a month, there was an implementation, the local version, where you could run open source model on your local laptop. Didn't even need an internet connection. And that was like, okay, this is the basis. This is like the node. And let's turn this into a full network. And so people started writing smart contracts. Those got written largely in November, December. The community has been testing. Auditors have been volunteering. Like, I've never seen like so many people come out of the woodwork trying to build something because like we've got till July. There's a lot of urgency there. So it's been so cool to sort of see it all come together. I've been mostly focused on the architecture, you know, sort of just open source contributor, volunteering and contributing to the GitHub. But it's come a long ways, really fast, to holding summits, to holding decentralized AI days, to people sort of throwing in different parts of the architecture and infrastructure. So yeah, it's been really wild. And the community, it looks like, will launch the smart contracts on Ethereum probably February 8th. So they've
right
been,
the corner,
they've been through audits. The community has audited them. There's been dedicated auditors. So, you know, it's just getting to that point where it's going to go on mainnet and then start rewarding people for capital and code and these other things. And I really like the way that the authors approached it. Instead of a token sale, instead of a foundation, like, look, we have yield now. Everybody has staked ETH.
Yeah.
Just put that in a contract and donate the yield. Now take anybody as principal, right? You're talking
about the bootstrapping period.
You already want to hold ETH.
Yeah.
I might as well point the yield at a project I'm passionate about and I want to exist.
Yeah.
Right? Because I can withdraw my ETH whenever I want and I just get the more tokens reward for the yield. And the yield goes into protocol on liquidity. So it sits in that AMM, in that Uniswap pool, and just keeps building. It buys half the tokens and the other half sit in staked ETH. And so it's just basically providing liquidity. It's not being sent to anybody. There's no team. There's no place it's being redirected. It's just building liquidity. So people offering compute or code, they can get liquidity on their more tokens. So you can kind of bootstrap this whole ecosystem into existence. I really like that. It feels like almost like a rebirth of token funding models.
Yes.
With no custodian, with no counterparty, right? You're not trusting some team you're sending the tokens to, and maybe one day they'll deliver some software. Like, software already works. It's already there. Let's just bootstrap this into a big network.
Can you walk us through? So I've read the overview of the project. It's an amazing design. I some really genius things in there. And I want to dig into those, but I think it might be helpful just for context for people listening. Walk us through the different contributors in the system, because it's built around four pillars of contribution. And I think it'd be really cool to walk through those and hear how each piece of the system comes together.
So the paper basically set aside four reward buckets. The first one was for capital. What we talked about was staked ETH. I think it's 24% of the emissions. The next one was code, right? A lot of times people reward compute and capital, but there's nothing for the coders.
Right.
And so it really reminds me of Ethereum, where you know, people forget with ETH, they airdropped ETH to every single programmer. that contributed before the launch, right? That's why they have all the developers. It's because they rewarded developers, yeah. Right? Shocking, right? So 24% of the rewards go to code providers. That's people writing the smart contracts, building the Node software, programming smart agents, like all of those people. And I've counted on the different repos, like 120 plus contributors already that have put in different code, and they're all going to get rewards in the ecosystem, the auditors, everybody, right? The next bucket is compute. In order to do AI, you need inference from a model, right? You need to be able to send a prompt to get a reply. And somebody's got to run the hardware to do that. So 24% of the rewards go towards inference. And it's agnostic. If people want to use Akash or BitTensor or any protocol they want to provide that inference, go for it, right? Morpheus doesn't care where the inference comes from as long as it's provably there and responsive and high quality, right? And then the last bucket, which I think is really interesting, is what they call community builders. It's basically front ends. So we have to get to all the way to the top of the tech stack. We can't just build in the back end. You have to end up with apps and websites and places where like end users can touch this. So they set aside 24% for the front end builders. And then the last 4% is a protection fund. There are always bugs in every piece of software ever written. Yeah. So have a dedicated fund day one that can do audits, pay for bug bounties, you know, even basically, you know, help people out if there is an attack or a bug or something like that. And so,
yeah, the protection fund, I think, is genius. I think it's really looking forward and saying, how do we make this a sustainable
protocol? Exactly. Well, and I always think like, you know, the future is uncertain and something's going to happen. It's smart if you say ahead of time what you're going to do in those scenarios, right? Here's the scenarios where it's going to pay a white hat who finds a bug and responsibly reports it. Here's what's going to happen if there's an attack and somebody loses funds. Here's how it pays them out, right? Here's what, if it's a catastrophic, like you guys remember the DAO on Ethereum,
right?
Like that was like 14% of all ETH or something. Yeah. That was enough that they were willing to hard fork the network. Like at what point are you willing to pause or hard fork the network to fix an issue? They did all of that sort of in the moment because they didn't have a plan. It's like, okay, let's have a plan. And so if you go on the GitHub, there's a good description of the protection fund. There's different scenarios.
Scenarios, they're built into the smart contract.
Yeah. Well, okay. They're written and then it defers to the code contributors as the oracles of like a binary thing. Did this happen?
Yeah.
And it's effectively the bucket that would be the hardest for somebody to game, is because it's the slowest thing you can earn is adding code.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So you couldn't have a governance attack where somebody buys a bunch of tokens on the open market and then votes their own proposal through kind of thing.
So like an incentivized, like will executive.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're not really acting as consensus. It's not a vote. It's like, did this thing happen? Yes or no?
Yeah.
Like you guys are the oracles with the expertise and the most, you know, sort of long-term value in the system. Did it happen? And honestly, that's how it worked in Bitcoin's early days.
Yeah.
Like people forget Gavin Andreessen paid out those Bitcoin miners when the accidental hard fork happened. Like that's what restored faith in Bitcoin. That like, oh, there was an error. You know, we're out of consensus. There was two chains for a few hours. We'll cover the miners.
Yeah.
Right. And so the developers kind of stepped up and took care of that, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, stewardship is like critical to making a long-lasting infrastructure really be long-lasting, right?
Exactly.
If not, like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so just to finish out the thoughts, so these four buckets, they go in sort of logical order, right? The code and the capital, the smart contracts exist. They can go live on February 8th. And then there's a 90-day bootstrapping period, right? Where people can provide stake to ETH, but they only can claim the more tokens at day 91. And this is built to prevent the Zcash problem. If you guys remember the Zcash launch in 2016, cool project, first implementation of zero knowledge proofs. Everybody wanted to own some of the first Zcash. And so there's only a couple of tokens in existence like that first hour. People drove up the price to like hundreds of thousands of dollars a token, like a, you know, multi-trillion dollar implied network value. Of course, as more tokens flowed in, it came down to a natural level. But if you go onto CoinMarketCap today,
yeah,
it still says that Zcash is down 99% from the all-time high. So if you didn't know that history, you think it's, oh, it's a failed project. Look at these guys. They never got back. Like, even though they've delivered incredible stuff, it doesn't matter because the chart looks terrible, right? And it didn't even catch those first hours, but it started at like $3,000 or something like that. So
it looks like the world's biggest rug pull.
Right. Even though it was a good project, right? And so by having 90 days of accumulation, there'll be like 1.2 million tokens in existence that bear launch, everybody's earned. There was no pre-mine. If you put in staked ETH, you provided code, you did these things, you got some of these tokens. So you should have a fairly good price discovery come day 91, instead of having the Zcash problem where like you're creating some crazy all-time high that'll never be reapproached. So once the token's in existence, once you can claim them, then you could pay for compute.
Yeah.
So the compute smart contracts logically have to be next. You can't pay for them before the token exists.
Yes.
Right. So those go live in like a phase two of the bootstrapping period. And then of course you have to have code, capital, compute all live before you can build front ends.
Sure.
Right. And so that's the last phase in the bootstrapping period.
What's the vision on the timeline to getting to that front end stage?
So the big thing is, because there's no central entity, there's no magic dates. Like, it is whatever the community and the open source developers.
More stage based, kind of like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, here's the phases. That. Here's what needs to be done to complete that phase. Don't pretend you know when that's going to be done. Like, that's how you end up with bad outcomes where like somebody's rushing to hit a magic date. Right. There's no company to set a date. It's like whenever the contracts are done. Like, hopefully the smart contracts for compute can get done during the first 90 days when it's bootstrapping capital and code. But there's no guarantee. Like, it might take longer. It might take 4 months. It might take 5 months. Like, my overall hope is that by July, because that's like the external thing hanging over all of our heads, that this will be decentralized as much as is possible, right, by July.
That makes sense. One of the things that I really like about this project is just a long-term perspective.
Sure.
And one of the things that stuck out to me in the tokenomics, so there's this tail emissions on the burn supply. Can you talk us through that a little bit, like how that keeps developers incentivized far into the future?
Yeah, no, I really liked this. First of all, there's a limit on the number of tokens. 42 million will ever exist, right? So it is a hard cap. But because there's a burn function, at the end of the first epoch, which is 16 years, right, to emit the first, 42 million tokens, it basically says, okay, half of whatever tokens were burned, let's say a few million tokens were burned during that first epoch, half of those can go back into emissions, right? So you're never going to break the 42 million, but like some portion of the comeback for the next 16-year epoch. So yeah, in the paper, it sets out the first 256 years of emissions, right? So you get long-term emissions. There'll still be rewards, 20 years from now, people providing compute and code and capital. Like, to be clear, that staked ETH, that 90 days is just when you can start claiming your more. Like, that process doesn't stop for the whole 16 years. People are competing to provide these four things the whole period.
Right.
And then it creates a tail emission for after that 16-year period.
And what are the burn interactions?
The primary one is similar to Ethereum, where people are sending fees. And in Ethereum, I think it's 25% of fees are burned in the system, which creates sort of this great scarcity effect. And so it's just sort of very much from the paper riffing off that.
So.
All great questions.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm digging into some of my notes because I took a bunch of notes when I was reading through this.
Yep.
Talk a little bit more about the liquidity provision and this concept of the techno capital machine that shows up in the intro. Talk a little bit more about that, because I think that's pretty fascinating too.
So, Willie from ATX DAO created this great meme around it recently. And it was like, the small-brained person creates a corporation, right? The large-brained person creates a foundation, right? The really smart person creates a DAO, and the genius uses the TCM, the techno capital machine. And it's an idea of basically sort of reinventing this model where a developer doesn't have to do any of that. They can just show up, get compute, liquidity, they can get front ends, they can use all of this infrastructure, issue a token, bear launch style, right? And leverage all of the smart contracts that the Morpheus community has basically been pioneering, using the staked ETH, using the idea of contributing yield, and extend that model beyond the single project and say, well, anybody can do this, right? You got a cool smart agent you want to build? Great. Launch it on Morpheus, connect it to the techno capital machine, and you'll have all of those things day one. And it also introduces this concept of atomic governance. Like, you can reduce a lot of the bureaucracy and friction from a system if, like, the person creating it is in charge of what they merge, what they accept. Right? It's sort of an extension of this modular code idea. Is anybody using Morpheus can run any model they want, use any compute they want. They can hook in or not to the capital and everything else, right? And so it creates this thing where there's just a marketplace. Instead of a bunch of committees, there's a marketplace right. for every piece of the code, and you're rewarded in proportion to the popularity of what you created. So to use the analogy, it's the app store.
Yeah.
You publish a thing, how much you can get paid? I don't know. It depends on how popular your app is, yeah. how many people pay for it, how many people use it. And so it uses that same concept. It's like, look, anybody can publish a smart agent. You're going to get it rewarded in proportion, right? Because it's all on-chain activity, right? So you can see how many fees, how many transactions flowed through that application, and then you reward that developer in proportion. So it's a competition for all the code.
So I guess on phase three, there's going to be a million developers that are all doing search, basically, that deploy. They're like, use my search app for more. But yeah.
People will compete for all of this.
Of course. Yeah. And that's good. Competition yep. is good.
Competition is great.
Now, of course, if this were happening on Apple, it'd be a 30% rake, right?
Right. Yes.
But there is another interesting aspect of this protocol that the fees are determined by the market.
Right.
They're not predetermined. So
right.
talk a little bit more about that, because I think that's another interesting aspect of this design.
So you could start with the fees, and this is getting pretty detailed, with the compute. So Eric Voorhees wrote a great paper a couple weeks ago called the Yellowstone compute model. And he's like, guys, instead of just doing a block reward and overpaying for compute in the early stage and not having enough resources for compute later, let's have an open marketplace. Let's have a bidding system, right? And it's almost like a one-sided bidding system. The compute providers are saying, hey, I've got this powerful GPU. I will offer it, and it'll do so many inferences per second. That's like the atomic unit in the AI context. Like, all tokens are a derivative of inferences per second, right, against a model. So I'm going to do this many IPF or IPS, and that's going to cost this, right? They're offering an ask to the market. I'll offer my compute at this price. Cool. Now every user that holds Morpheus tokens, they have a pro rata right to the inference on the network every day. So if you're holding 1% of the more tokens and you're running a website where you're offering like ChatGPT, great, you've got 1% of the inference that's available. And effectively, the developers are building a router that will go with the lowest price, but still meets the speed requirements,
right?
For the inference. And that's why it's inference per second. Because you have to have that time aspect and know whether it's a fast reply.
Sure.
And ultimately, the user can grade it and say, oh, yeah, it was a good reply, or, oh, this came back as nonsense, right? And they push button or reply in their interface, mm-hmm. basically to downgrade the compute provider if they're not providing good results, right? So I think that Yellowstone compute model is really interesting. And so a lot of the open source developers are sort of racing to implement that
right.
during this bootstrapping period of the next time.
A piece of that maybe, it wasn't super clear to me from the paper, but maybe there's a connection here with the proof of contribution mm-hmm. and how developers or contributors to the network proving that they're actually doing what they say they're doing on the network.
Right. So are you thinking about in the code context or the front end context?
More in the code context. Like, how does that dynamic work?
So, you know, this is effectively two sides of the market. Right? There are people building smart agents, and that's easy, right? It's just whatever your on-chain usage is, right? If you've, you know, ended up producing, your app has produced 10% of the fees in the network, okay, great.
Sure.
10% of the reward. The harder to define one is, call it like the infrastructure on the other side, right? So there are people demanding inference. Those are people creating demand, you know, for the system. And but there's supply. Who wrote the smart contracts? Who did the audits? Who created the node infrastructure? Who created all the infrastructure in the back end for those smart agents? And so far, the community has just been using hours, right? It's not perfect, but it's a pretty good gauge of how many hours went into writing this code. Now, the flip side of that is somebody could come along and say, oh, yeah, I wrote this paper and it took me 10,000 hours. It's like, yeah, sure, it did. And so at the end of the day, the check is the repo owner. Does the repository owner decide to merge in that code? And it creates another market. It creates another marketplace, right? Because now I'm, you know, as a repo owner, I'm going to only merge in code that's valuable to me, of good quality, asking for a reasonable number of hours, because my rewards are also denominated in the amount of hours in that same repository. So if some
good check.
That's a good check, right?
Imagine technology that aligns incentives.
I know, right? So, and you know, if anybody felt strong enough, they could make their own repo and try to recruit a bunch of people to contribute to it. But guess what? That takes a lot of work. And so most people probably just contribute to an existing repo, but hopefully you'll end up with, just like Ethereum has, multiple implementations of different parts of the modular infrastructure, multiple versions of the smart contracts and the nodes, maybe different language implementations. That's great. Like, that is encouraged. That is success. And then people will naturally say, oh yeah, I'm going to go use this one because it has the best code or the best maintainers or is the most responsive or whatever, right? You know, there's probably not the resources to do that day one. That's what you hope evolves. And that's what the incentives, you know, will push people towards the next few years.
So I think my final question here is around the this design of stake on L1, reward on L2. So this relationship between Ethereum and Arbitrum. So talk a little bit about that. I mean, it makes sense, right? Because of the low fees on the L2, but you know, what's the rationale? Is it strictly fee-based or?
That's part of it. You know, the paper describes Morpheus as chain agnostic. So I hope Morpheus is extended to all L2s, onto Solana, onto Cosmos, onto everything, right? There's no reason it has to stay on one, right? So it can be chain agnostic. But as a starting point, Ethereum is a good place to start, right? If you want yield, $20 billion of staked ETH floating around and a lot of enthusiastic community members. And if you look at the L2s, the most active staked ETH is on Arbitrum. So the original paper proposed Base, and I was like, well, there's only one like really aggregator, maybe that's too centralized. And then, you know, it was proposed to do Polygon, which is great, much more decentralized, but doesn't have as much staked ETH. And then everybody was like, well, like we build a lot of contracts, we're all using Arbitrum because that's where all the staked ETH is. Like, okay, that's a good starting place. But because these are EVM contracts, they can pretty easily be extended to all these other layer twos. And that's what I hope to see. So, but yes, from a fee perspective, if you want to send inference and you might be paying, you know, effectively a few bucks, you don't want your transaction fee to be also a few bucks, right? So Arbitrum being 1-2 pennies is a huge advantage for the utility. Now, the community is also very vocal. A lot of people don't care about fees. Those tend to be the capital providers, which is different from the guy who wants to consume inference. 100%. So I think you're going to end up with both. Obviously, people are going to set up pools for ETH on layer one. And for those that don't care about fees, if that's the most liquid, they'll just go there. That's cool. No reason not to. But for like the utility of the network, it's really helpful to have an L2, which is fairly decentralized, lots of liquid staked ETH, and low on fees and transaction costs, right? That's important as a design element of like the actual utility of the network. So I think you got to have both.
Yeah, no, I think it's kind of sense.
Arbitrum logo also kind of vibes with the Morpheus logo.
Yeah, it's sort of like a retro futurism kind of vibe.
I might have missed this or something, but how is Morpheus governed? Is there some type of decentralized governance to it or?
No.
No.
There's no foundation. There's no company. There's no central, there's no concept of like core developers. I think often those concepts are just people trying to gain power over systems. So I don't think most people need titles. People are usually identifiable by the work that they do and reputation they develop. And so the main idea for governance has been this atomic governance concept that's described in the Techno-Capital Machine paper, which is, look, if we build this right, it's just a marketplace. The governance is everybody selecting model they want, smart agent they want, smart contracts they want to use, the L1 they want to use. Like, Morpheus is not trying to set any of those things in stone. It's like, no, you can use any of them and it'll work in this framework. And that's, you know, sort of maybe an important thing to emphasize. The genius of Ethereum was its generalizability, right? Every protocol before Ethereum is like, oh, we built a DEX and that's the only thing it does. Or we built an asset and that's the only thing it does. And Vitalik came in and he was like, look, generalized scripts, generalized smart contracts. You can write whatever you want. You'll notice like nobody building Morpheus is like trying to build in apps. It's like, no. Anybody can launch on Morpheus. What are the common thing everybody needs? Compute, front ends, liquidity. You know, these are the core things. These are the core codes and pieces that everybody needs. So if Ethereum was that for smart contracts, Morpheus is that for smart agents, right? It's a generalized protocol. You can run any smart agent you want. There's no permission. It's not optimized for one use case. It's way too early in the ecosystem to start optimizing or going for like a monolithic, you know, implementation of something like the integrated approach. It's too early for that, right? There needs to be a lot of experimentation, a lot of cool projects shipped, and just let's see what the market likes.
Yeah.
I like it. A meritocracy and about being like, just be good at what the fuck you do.
Yep.
And be like, here's your job. Here's your payment for doing it. And yep. Just don't fuck up the market.
Yeah. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So no, go ahead. Sorry.
No.
I was just going to zoom back out. You know, I think we went really deep on some of these things and super interesting projects. And when you think about the future, and obviously this project built the future, but if you project out, say, 10 years, 15 years, you know, if things go the way that everybody contributing wants it to go, what's the net impact on AI and this macro trend of AI? You know, a lot of people think we're going to be to AGI at some point soon. Like, what's the impact of more on this whole narrative?
So I would say, you know, Morpheus is like at the forefront of pioneering open source AI. Like, this entire tech stack is open source. And if people haven't noticed, the open source is almost as good as like a ChatGPT-4 now. Like, we're at like 95% of the accuracy. And so that's like, it's going to cross this chasm and it's just going to be open source models are the best.
That's why Google wrote that law.
Yeah. That's exactly it. There is no technical moat that will make the proprietary models better. I believe it's inevitable that the open source models will be far better because there's a much larger open source community outside than inside any one company.
Incentivize them with Morpheus.
And you can incentivize them and it can run on these permissionless rails and it doesn't care which jurisdiction, it works everywhere in the world. This is why Linux is 95% of all servers. This is why Android won in smartphones. We need that for AI. Personal open source AI tech stack that you own and control. Right. So if we can, you know, tilt the universe towards that outcome, that's what I want. Right. And the cool thing is, you don't have to convince everybody. As soon as the tool exists, you can just opt into it. You don't have to wait around for anybody else. It's like, I volunteered with like, you know, Audit the Fed and, you know, Ron Paul, you know, Revolution in 2007. Like, we were never going to convince 51% of people to audit the central bank. But I could just buy Bitcoin and opt out of their federal monetary policy and just go live my life, right? Like, haven't worried about politics since, right? And then, that's the world I want to live in, is I can progressively opt out of all this state infrastructure, all these violence-based consensus mechanisms, and replace them with math-based consensus mechanisms. And that's what I want to spend the next 10, 20 years doing.
Is it even possible to audit the?
Yeah. Well, they've got this database and it says some things. Yeah. So
what we've been trying to do is it like the DOD the last like 5 years or whatever? I don't think that's ever gone through successfully, or they've never passed an audit.
Yeah.
So what
that's
makes
just the ladder there? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, the central bank's never going to fucking pass an audit.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Exactly. So that's where I hope it goes, is you'll have really powerful open source AI in the hands of individuals. You'll have your data, which you own, controlled by your wallet, which only you can sign. And this model will be working on your behalf. It's on your side. It's not on Google's side. It's not on some government side. It's your AI. And so instead of AGI, I started thinking about, you know, human augmented intelligence. That's where we're at right now.
Yeah.
We're actually pretty far from like it being conscious or sentient or all these things. But we are at a tipping point where like I can be much better at what I do if I have an AI.
Right.
So, and that's going to become the table stakes.
So personalized intelligence instead of collective intelligence.
Correct. Collective intelligence tends to give you bad outcomes.
Generally.
Yes. Central planners do not have a good record.
Oh, yes.
Of creating outcomes for lots of people. So I think this idea or fantasy about like group alignment of AI, it's impossible on like an information theory basis. What we're going to get is personal alignment of AI. That's what I want, right? Is to push that power to the edge. That's what Elon tried to do with OpenAI back when it was open source, back when it was a foundation, before they took the money from Microsoft, before they closed sourced everything, before they sort of gave up on those values. That's what inspired that community. And so it's time for, you know, basically a rebirth.
The true tragedy right there.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, what I would say is as soon as they incorporated, it was inevitable because they were touching the state. Mm-hmm. And in one way or another, whether it was regulatory or they sold out to big corporate, whatever, it was inevitably going to happen because there's just too much money on the table. Now you flip it and create an incentive for decentralized compute. I think there'll be far more compute for AI from frameworks like Morpheus than will ever be inside any one company, right? Because this Bitcoin has far more compute than any nation state at this point. We're going to do the same thing.
Well, and once you get to that front end layer,
yeah,
you know, once you have the creativity of people that can just start interacting with the building of that interaction layer, you know, you're just going to get use cases that could never be anticipated by corporations.
Right. And guys, who's going to give the AI a bank account? Oh, that's right. Nobody, because it can't pass KYC and the rails don't work outside one jurisdiction. So the only thing that makes sense to me is AI using crypto, right? We built programmable money for a reason. We've got all these rails. That's naturally the thing that AI is going to be, that's the superpower, right? It's going to be able to pay other agents, machine to machine payments, cross-border payments. All these things are easy in a Web3 context, right? And so to comically see the limitations of like a ChatGPT, it can only give you information, still can't touch a token, still can't make a payment for you, will never be able to do those things because of the regulatory environment it's under. They're trying to do stuff to the application layer that ought to be done.
Yeah, and that's an interesting unlock, I think, or inflection point for consumers, because when they start, you know, like you said, like your mom interacting with ChatGPT, it's getting easy enough and the results are acceptable enough to a lot of people that it's like, well, why can't you do something else with this?
Yeah,
that's right.
And that's going to be that frustrating point where it's like, oh, but I can do that with Web3?
Yeah.
Cool. And again, if this is freaking cool, I don't care what it's called. Call it Web3, call it crypto.
Sure.
I'm in.
And tell me the billion guys in India that are all coming online are going to pay $20 a month to Microsoft.
Yeah,
like they're not, right? That's why open source tends to win, is you've reduced the marginal cost to the new user to zero. You didn't want to pay for another, you know, software operating system for every new server you spun up. That didn't make any sense. So you just use Linux.
Yeah.
That's why it's 95% of the market share. Same with Android phones. Like Android phones now sell like at the low end for the price you would have had to pay license fee for an operating system for like Microsoft or something. So like the $30 Android phone was never going to use anything other than open source.
Yeah.
So for me, it just feels like basic math. This is the outcome we're going to end up with. But I want to point, okay, if that's going to be the outcome, let's give people a wallet in the process. Let's hook it up into smart contracts that will, you know, make them more wealthy.
Fully online.
Let's bring them fully online.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, David, this has been an awesome conversation.
Yeah.
I know that you are headed to East Denver soon.
Sure.
Where can people catch up with you, IRL or on the interwebs?
So if you go to decentralizeai.org, there's the invite up there. It's already like 400 people that have applied for the Decentralized AI Day. A bunch of the community is hosting on the 28th. So that's one day before the main event. So if you come a little bit early, try to get into the AI Day. There'll be a ton of other decentralized AI events that whole week, 26th, 27th. And there'll be a ton of people wandering around ETH Denver with Morpheus t-shirts. So you'll probably find them and get to kind of talk to the community members in person. But, you know, it's been amazing how it's come together. And, you know, I'm very much looking forward to sort of the impact this is going to have in 24.
Yeah, absolutely. This is cool. Oh, by the way, where do people go to try out Morpheus and start creating their smart APIs?
So Eric Voorhees created a great community site called MOR.org. There's a bunch of other community sites, but his is beautiful. It has a great front end. And there's a download link. So if you use Mac or Linux, there's already a download for you. Get a copy of Morpheus, run it on your local machine. As long as you have 16 gigs, it defaults to a 7 billion parameter model, which is 14 gigs of space. Almost all modern computers.
Which is only 13 under the limit.
Right? Yeah. Nicely under that permissionless limit. Yeah. Glad you noticed that. But, you know, Eric's vision is like a permissionless ChatGPT, right? So he just wants to make a simple way for anybody to use one of these uncensored LLMs. And Morpheus is just the infrastructure in the back end that makes that possible, right? And so, you know, he's so good at creating these frictionless, you know, sort of no user account, no sign up, just land on a page and use it. So it's really cool. It's going to be awesome to see that sort of start going online. So mor.org, there's a copy of the white paper on there. There's a link to the GitHub. There's a ton of people flowing into the Discord. So a lot of the in-depth conversation tends to be
amazing.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, thanks so much.
Good discussion, guys.
Thanks, bro.
Absolutely.